maybe they can learn from each other and tell figure out what the other was. So the rabbit was excited. He said, that's great. He goes, I'll tell you what, you go first. You tell me what I am. So the rabbit lay still, and the snake proceeded to crawl all around the rabbit, and then he started to wrap his coils around him and used his tongue, and he flicked it all around the rabbit's ears and nose, and at last he curled up, and he said, well, he said, you've got soft fur, a big cotton tail, and big floppy ears. I think you're a rabbit. And the rabbit was overjoyed. Oh, that's wonderful. I always wanted to know what I was. And I said, now tell me. I want to know what I am. So the rabbit said, okay, stretch out and lay down. So the snake stretched out and laid down, and the rabbit hopped up and down the snake, and he rubbed his paw all up and down him and over his head and around his tongue, and he said, okay, what am I? He was so excited, he couldn't wait to figure out. And the rabbit said, well, you're scaly, crooked, you've got a forked tongue, and no backbone. You must be French. So that's my taunting insult to our allies that were really upset that Bush was reelected. So... you know, President Bush is being blamed for a suicide at Ground Zero. Now, there was a guy who was so upset, I kid you not, his name was Andrew Veal, and so upset was this man that he took a 12-gauge shotgun to Ground Zero at the World Trade Center site and ended his life. Family members said that Veal, a registered Democrat, was despondent over Bush's defeat of Senator John Kerry, and a second source said Veal, who lived in Athens, Georgia, worked for the University of Georgia, was also adamantly opposed to the war. Now, you say, oh, that's a tragic thing. Well, you know what's funny, though, when you look at how liberals, and the guy worked at a university, hates guns, goes to a city that bans guns, and ends his life with guns. Typical of the hypocrisy. And you say, well, that's a terrible thing. Well, I beg to disagree. I think this man should be a liberal martyr, and he has set forth a precedent worth emulating by his peers. So I propose an email campaign to the Earth Liberation Front, Sierra Club, Now, Handgun Control Inc., Michael Moore, Rock the Vote, Jacques Chirac, Kofi Annan, Bruce Springsteen, Alec Baldwin, Cher, Rosie, Oprah, Ted Koppel, and Dan Rather, and the rest of the Hollywood fruitcakes, suggesting that this man who so loved his country took the noble cause to reduce the population and thereby save the planet, that they should follow suit. So amen. I propose that's an email campaign that we begin. So enough of the political thing. All right. Turn your Bibles this morning to 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 3. We're going to look at a couple things this morning and see how much time I got at some things false, things foolish, and things of the future. Things false, things foolish, and things of the future. And 2 Peter 3, verse 3, he says that knowing this first, that there shall come in the last days scoffers, walking after their own lust, and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. And now, as you read on through there, if you want, and Peter continues and gives us an example of the scoffers in Noah's day, and tells us about the 1,000-year-day system there in verse 8, and then we can look at how there's approximately 6,000 years from Adam to now, and then we can look and say that, you know, that, well, we're at the end times. We can surmise that. Now, the critical verse in understanding this, and where people always go wrong, is Matthew 24, verse 36. And I'll flip over there, and this is your parallel verse. You got to have this one. Because the disciples in Matthew 24, that's a sign of the tribulation, the times, they asked a specific question in verse 3. And the disciples said, tell us, when shall these things be? What shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? So in Matthew 24, 3, they're asking this question to the Lord, and then he proceeds to answer their questions and tell them about the end times and the tribulation. And in verse 36, he emphasizes that no man, but of that day and hour, knoweth no man, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. Okay, but as in the days of Noah were, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. So in this time period, people have always tried to make predictions since the birth of Christ. And over in 2 Thessalonians 2:2, Paul had to, wrote and addressed the fact that they were upset because some had already predicted that the Lord was returning. And so they were upset about that. So I want to look at it, just a history of some false predictions. And some of these are amazing, and you might have a little bit of fun with them. And next time you run into a Jehovah's Witness, you'll have a ball with them. All right, in AD 54, that was when Paul had to kind of quell the little Thessalonian upset because they had said that the rapture was already taking place. And in 1524, a guy named Munzer, and he was a leader of German peasants, and he had a vision from God that Christ was near. And after Munzer and his men destroyed the enemy army, the German army, basically, Jesus would return, and they were to lead a rebellion against the government troops. Now, needless to say, that didn't work, because Munzer also had a vision that he would be able to extend his cloak and catch the cannonballs of the enemy fire. And Munster and his troops were mowed down, predictably, by cannon fire. So that one didn't work. In 1809, Mary Bateman, fascinating woman, Mary Bateman, she specialized in fortune-telling, and she had a magic chicken, kid you not, magic chicken that laid eggs with end-time messages on them. And one message said that Christ was coming, and believe it or not, this created quite an uproar in the town and the community where she was. So somebody, obviously with a bit of a brain, sneaked in on Mary and saw her in the barn with a message on the egg, putting the egg back into the chicken. So later, Mary was hanged for poisoning a wealthy client, and history doesn't really record whether the offended chicken attended the hanging, so Mary didn't make it either. In 1843, William Miller, he was the founder of an end times movement that was so prominent that it got its own name, Millerism, 1843. And from his studies, he determined that the end times would be in 1843 to 1844, and the date passed in 1844 and nothing happened, and then he set a second date in October of 1844 and nothing happened, and the movement collapsed. And so in 1914, a fellow named Charles Russell, some of you might remember him, he was a protege, a student of William Miller. He founded his own organization that involved in the Jehovah's Witnesses. And in 1914, he predicted the return of Jesus Christ. In 1918, they tried new math, and that didn't work. The JW struck out again. And then they didn't have any better luck in 1925. And in 1941, once again, they predicted that it was going to be Armageddon by the end of 1941. And they were back at it again in 1975. And at this time, the Watchtower had 13 million subscribers. In 1984, just to make sure nobody would top them out, they predicted that the end times would happen again. And so if they come knocking on your door, and you can get, they like to go to the Old Testament, you know, and Jehovah and all that stuff. So say, you know what? Well, the Bible says, pick up a rock and, you know, hold it in their face. Because they made false predictions in 1914, 1918, 1925, 1975, and 1984. But they'll be back. 1988, how many remember that? 88 reasons why the rapture is going to happen in 88. Okay, that predicted a date, September 11th to September 13th. That rolled around, didn't happen. So in 1989, the same guy, Edgar Weisenhot, wrote another book called The 89 Reasons the Rapture will Happen in 89, and needless to say, it didn't sell quite so well. 1991, Calypso Louis, or Louis Farrakhan, the Nation of Islam leader, he proclaimed that the Gulf War would be the end of Armageddon. That didn't come out. How many remember 1993? 2000 minus 7, that's the rapture, remember that one? Okay, 1994, Harold Camping. Anybody ever listen to Harold Camping on family radio, Dr. Dry as Dust? Yeah. Oh, is he annoying? I mean, he really is. Yeah, you can hit him, 91.9, is it 90.9 or 91.9, Mike? You remember? 91.9, yeah. Anyways, he wrote a book called Are You Ready in September of 94 that was full of numerology that added up to 1994 as the date of Christ's return. It didn't happen. And after promising that they would not make any more predictions, the JWs fell off the bandwagon again in 1994 because it was the conclusion of an 80-year generation, according to them, adding 80 to 1914. So there they did it again. In 1998, numerology had that, 666 times 3. Okay, there's 1988. 1989, Jack Van Impe predicted that that was going to be Armageddon. And so in 1992, he was selling tapes like wildfire called Are You Ready for $24.95 plus shipping and handling, because that was going to be back in 1992. And then in numerology, year 2000, you take 2000, divide that by 3, Satan's number 666.666666, you get the idea. 2011 to 2018, Jack Van Impe's been back at it again because he's used new math to determine that the length of a generation is 51 years, and that if you had 51 years to 1967, the year Israel recaptured Jerusalem, you would come up with 2018, deduct 7 years, you'd come up with 2011. Folks, it's a mess. It's a mess. So that's the latest. And an untold number of people have tried to predict the dates of the Lord's return using elaborate timetables, and most of the date setters, and if you think you're smart enough, remember that you've got to take into account from 100 B.C. to 2000 A.D., you got to contend with the fact that in 46 B.C., the year was 445 days long. There was no year 0 B.C. In 1582, we went from Julian years of 360 days to Gregorian years of 365 days, and you've got leap years figured in there. So there's a little bit more complex than that. And if you think you're smart as God, go ahead and make a fool out of yourself like these people did. And I don't think we'll know the exact date of Christ's return, because that would be unscriptural if we did. I mean, it's God's nature to act independently from man's thinking. And if he returned on a date that somebody figured out, it would deprive God of the glory. And he's not going to share that spotlight with anybody. And those predictions I read, those are just a few. I mean, there were dozens and dozens that I called out of there that were even wilder. And the result, is it's disillusionment by the flock and disdain by the lost. And with so many failed predictions by Christians out there, You know, you really need a thorough understanding of history and the doctrines of the Charismatics and JWs and Mormons and Water Dogs and explain the mess to clear up the cobwebs and confusion. Because you talk to people, and they really are hungry for the truth, a lot of them, but they look at this Christianity and the cesspool that's become, and they don't want to touch it. And then I've explained the rapture doctrine to people who have specifically asked me, what's this whole left behind? What's this rapture stuff? Catholic friends of mine. And gone through chapter, verse, and explained it to them. And then they've turned around and said, yeah, and that's what the Heaven's Gate people believed. And look what a bunch of psychos they were. And then, oh, yeah, and oh, how about Jim Jones? Don't drink the Kool-Aid. You know, remember him. And they've done that. You know, and you can get offended at that, but roll with the punches. I mean, they have a right to be skeptical because of what Christians have said. It's no wonder people confuse. You look at the other mess, like contemporary Christian music. You can tell that stuff's a fake, and pastor's been teaching on that. Even conservatives like Billy Graham, so-called conservatives, you know, that whole mantra penetrates the SBC at its deepest levels. And no man in this generation epitomizes theological compromise like Billy Graham. I said, oh, that icon of the faith. Yeah, really. You know, Christianity Today said it would be difficult to overestimate Graham's importance in the last 50 years of evangelicalism. Graham personally embodied most of the characteristics of this resurgent evangelicalism by de-emphasizing doctrinal and denominational differences among Christians. That's a direct disobedience to the Bible. And nowhere does the Bible de-emphasize doctrinal differences. They want to sacrifice that thing on the altar of getting alongism. And then you turn on Channel 38, TBN, you know, Paul and Jan Crouch's stuff. You know, they're the firm believers in prosperity gospel, the hallelujah, let me fool you crowd, and praying in lots of wealth and riches. And they got a lifestyle to prove it. They've got their annual salary, $764,000. They own a $7.2 million jet and 30 homes. One of them has a $10,000 wine cabinet. Two of the homes are multi-million dollar mansions in a gated community overlooking the Pacific Ocean. Their balance sheet for 2002 was the last I could find, and its net assets of $583 million, which has $238 million in treasury bonds, $31 million in cash. They spread this radical, unscriptural message of this charismatic stuff around the world. And it came to light in 97 that Paul Crouch paid $425,000 to an employee to keep quiet a little tryst he had with another male employee. The Bible says, prove that all things, hold fast to that which is good. That's what we're supposed to do. And Christians don't prove things. And when you talk to people like that, they look at this mess out there, and you got to be ready to defend that. I mean, if you get a chance that somebody's really interested, they will pepper you with questions. All right, there's a lot of false things out there. Now look at some foolish things, Now turn over to Proverbs chapter 1, verse 26. A lot of foolish things. You could go on and on and on about this. But in Proverbs 1, 26, and I know I'm taking this kind of out of context, and I'll go into that in just a little bit. But terrifying verses. Really. But God says that I'll also laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your fear cometh, and when your fear cometh as desolation, and your destruction cometh as a whirlwind, when distress and anguish come upon you. They shall call upon me, but I will not answer. They shall seek me early, but they shall not find me. For they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord. And I know doctrinally this applies to the Jews in the tribulation, but spiritually it applies to a Christ rejecter in any age. And you notice how God laughs at calamity. I mean, God is going to laugh at these people when the world is melting down around them and they're crying out to whatever God and crying out to money and crying out to the things that they worship and their pagan gods, and he's going to laugh. And, you know, and God laughs at the things that we build and that we say are so holy and wonderful. And we have made an icon, like, say, out of the World Trade Center. The things that we build are man-made things are icons. Two big ones are what? Are the Glen Canyon Dam and Lake Powell and Lake Mead and the Hoover Dam. Huge tourist attractions and draws just in themselves. They're kind of icons. It's like if you go out west, that's one of the shrines to go see. And it's pretty. There's no doubt about that. But you say, well, what does that have to do with things foolish? Well, so stay with me for just a second. I think that our American version of Babylon is probably Las Vegas. That's the closest thing we can come. And it would have never grown to its size and popularity without having Lake Mead nearby. And Vegas is powered by hydroelectric generation that comes from Lake Mead. And it's its sole source of water. And so Vegas in the recent years with the massive building boom has undergone an incredible population explosion, and people are going to this desert city. And I don't have to describe what kind of place this is. You know, you can figure that out. And but right now, the water situation is getting so serious that they're paying millions of dollars each year to homeowners to rip out their grass and put in natural landscape. See, when Lake Powell was full only 5 years ago, and what they've had is a record-setting drought, the worst in the last 500 years, And 5 years ago, they had 250 square miles of area. Today, the lake is down 129 or 130 feet in elevation. That's a big drop in a lake, folks. I'm not talking that much shallower. So the lake is half the size it was just 5 years ago. And in 2 years, depending on the weather, a lake pile could reach what a hydrologist say is an active pool. That means the water coming in will not even be enough to provide them any power. And if it continues another 2 years, the lake will drop another 130 feet. And currently, this lake is dropping at about 20 inches per week, Lake Powell and Lake Mead, because the drought's so bad. You see, they would have to have record-setting floods, 100-year floods for anybody in the engineering field. When we design sewer systems and you design retention pond capabilities, you design them so that, in theory, like a rain that every 50 years will be handled by this drainage system. But you would have to have a flood that theoretically only occurs once every 100 years back-to-back-to-back-to-back to actually recharge these reservoirs, because you've got 16.5 million feet of water, acre-feet. An acre-foot is 1 acre of water a foot deep, discharging and being used by downstream consumers, and only 15 million feet go in every year. And on an average, this year, only 1/4 of that amount of the usual 15 million went in. So power generation has dropped accordingly. Mead is down 17%, Lake Powell is down 30%, and the National Park Service is spending millions and millions of dollars extending the boat ramps down to the water, because every time they build a new boat ramp to get these nice boats down in there, they turn around and the lake drops, and then it's more mud and more mud and more mud. So they've got contractors on retainers that just keep pouring ramps deeper and deeper into this lake. And it's a foolish thing to build a city in a desert, folks. And it's going to be something to see when God dries that thing up. Now, maybe he'll send a lot of rain and change things, but they're going to be in a world of hurt. Real estate will be cheap, I guarantee you that. All right, looking at the future in economic perspectives, the future. We looked at, there's just so much stuff you can go over, but one of the things is called the Verichip. Now, Brother Eric had some neat stuff on that, and maybe its possibility of bearing the mark of the beast, and it's an injectable transponder. Now, for the history of that, some of you that know it's an injectable transponder is the size of a grain of rice, and they've used them for years in pets. And what they do is if you've got a cat or a dog, you put it in the muscle or the loose skin behind the shoulder blades, and inject that in there, and then that thing has a barcode on it, and when you pass a reader over that, it transmits a RF signal, and then it tells you the ID number of the cat, so you can, you know, somebody, if it does, if somebody does turn your kitty into a pet shelter or a dog, you can, you know, that you're in a registered database. And what Verichip is doing is proposing to use this thing in human beings, okay? And if you want to find out about it, you can, a little bit, some of you guys know Catherine Albrecht or heard her videos and stuff. Okay, well, she's got a website called spychip.com, and you can go to there at spychip.com and study on that a little bit more. And this chip, if they do implant it, they're not going to be able to GPS track you right now because the technology has not evolved to get that small. Right now, the best GPS transmitters are about a little bigger than my wristwatch, and there's companies that sell them where you would tack this onto your kid or your senior citizen patient, spychip.com. Spychip, one word, .com, yes. And then that's about the best technology they've got. So you can pay a subscription service like you would a cell phone bill, and then they can track your kid or the elderly or senior citizens. They're marketing it that way. But the problem is this thing can be removed, and they want a unique biometric identifier that can be read by RFID readers. If you've ever gone to Walmart and they haven't scanned something that you've bought and the alarms go off, what they're doing is you're going through an RFID reader, and they're picking up the signal. Now, what they are proposing that this could be used for identification, reduce theft, and everything else, but the FDA has found out that the problem is when you, if you ever have to get, how many of you guys, have anybody had an MRI? You know what the prep, Dean, it's bait, do you want to explain that briefly? Right. Okay. Thank you. And now what they found out, the FDA has said that when they do that, when all that energy goes through your body and it hits that pulse radio frequency hits this chip, that it has the potential to cause severe burns in that. So there's already a downside in that. And if you go to spychips.com and look at the gizmo that they inject you, want to inject this thing in, it's pretty rough looking. But I'm not saying that is the mark of the beast, but that's something to keep an eye on, this thing called the Verichip and where this thing goes, because as the technology comes and continues to develop and get smaller, faster, better, this injectable chip may well be something that we have to concern with. All right, future and a defense. Now, some of you wonder, and to follow world affairs closely, that Iran is probably our next target, that we're going to go after them. And they've recently completed a Soviet-designed nuclear reactor, and they brought that online, and it's capable of producing weapons-grade plutonium. Now, if you thought the Iraqis were nuts, the Iranians are nuttier. And they're probably next in our target. Now, what's happened is the Israelis, courtesy of our government loans, have purchased a whole flock of 25 F-15s with advanced weaponry and a big old pile of the 5,000-pound bunker busters. Now, if you remember history, what the Israelis did back in the 1980s when Hussein was going to bring on the French-built reactor, they are our friends, the Israelis took off and they blew that reactor apart right before it could get started and before they could actually begin producing anything. And the world cried out how mean the Jews were, but they blew apart Saddam Hussein's nuclear reactor before they could get started. Now, the engines may be firing up, but if they do go after Iran, and we will be dragged into them, because guess what airspace they're going to fly over to get to? Iraq. They'll have to get security clearance for us, so they'll rope us into it. And they said, well, what does this have to do with some of the future of our defense? Well, everything, in a way, because any history buffs remember the Battle of Cannae a little bit? And that was when the Carthaginian general Hannibal tempted a much larger Roman force into a fateful advance. And what he did was feign weakness and drew them further and further out, and they enveloped them from the flanks and collapsed. Now, turn your Bibles in Joshua 8, verse 15 to 29, because this battle technique is absolutely not new. Joshua was at least the first recorded user of this that I can find. But in Joshua 8:15, or actually looking 14, they were going into battle against the people of Ai. And it says, and it came to pass, in Joshua 8:14, that when the king of Ai saw it, that they hasted up and rose early, and the men of the city went out against Israel to battle, he and all his appointed people, at a time appointed before the plain, and wist not that there were liars in ambush against him behind the city. And Joshua and all Israel made as if they were beaten before them, and fled by the way of the wilderness. And all the people that were in Ai called together to pursue after them, and they pursued after Joshua, and were drawn away from the city, and there was not a man left in Ai or Bethel that went not out after Israel, and they left the city open and pursued after Israel. Trap was spread. Then the Lord said unto Joshua, stretch out the spear that is in thy hand toward Ai, for I will give it into thine hand. And Joshua stretched out the spear that he had in his hand toward the city. And the ambush arose quickly out of their place, and they ran as soon as he had stretched out his hand, and they entered into the city and took it and hasted to set the city on fire. And the men of Ai looked behind them, and they saw, and behold, the smoke of the city ascended up into heaven, and they had no power to flee this way or that way, and the people that fled to the wilderness turned back upon their pursuers. Well, guess what? They were in a world of hurt. If you flip over, I think it is to verse 29. I think I flipped my page too far here. And the king of Ai, he hanged on a tree until eventide, and as soon as the sun was down, they took his carcass off, wiped him out to the man. The technique of drawing your enemy in and attacking and cutting off their escape is well known and well used, and that's been going on since 1450. Now, the Iranians want to repeat this battle, and they want to do it in the Persian Gulf. The Persian Gulf is roughly a 300-mile-long bathtub that's not that wide. And it's a nightmare for logistics for our troops when they go in there because it's shallow. The deepest point's only about 330 feet. So once they get in there and we have carrier battle groups that are supplying things in Iraq, the problem is they don't have a lot of maneuvering room. And if you go back and remember a little bit about what happened with the Falklands War, in the Falklands War, when the British got into it with the Argentines had these Exocet missiles sold that were French. And they only had five missiles, but with those five missiles, they sunk two British warships. And it was a staggering loss for the British. They had 50 or 60 missiles, the British probably wouldn't have won that war because they would have blew too many of their ships out of the water. And the Exocet has, it's a heat-seeking, not super-fast missile, but it flies at water level. And in 1987, our destroyer Stark was in the Gulf, and an Iraqi jet, a Mirage from, thank you, France, from 50 miles away, launched an Exocet. They saw the plane, but then they never saw the missile drop, and it came in, and it got smacked by two. It nearly cut the ship in half, and we lost 37 sailors. So in result, we developed the Phalanx, which is a radar-controlled, very depleted uranium-round Gatling gun. And that's got about 10 seconds to lock on and take out an incoming missile. So the Russians turned around, and they built a thing called the Sunburn. The last time I was here, I talked a little bit about this. And what this is a supersonic Mach 2.1 missile, which flies at sea level, and then it has real erratic fishtailing maneuvers as it approaches our water. The Russians designed the Sunburn specifically to take out American carrier battle groups, and what they've done is sold them to the Iranians, who've got them all over the shore. Now, the Exocet has a range of 50 miles. The Sunburn can reach 100 miles. So what the battle plan is, if they can lure one or two of our carrier battle groups in there, then you can plug the whole Persian Gulf by dropping one tanker in the Strait of Hormuz. That's a narrow strait where everything's got to pass through. That's the bottleneck. So the enveloping trap, if they plug the Strait of Hormuz by dropping a ship there, then what our troops could face would be barrage after barrage after barrage of exocets, and then they would hit us with the Sunburns. And this thing can deliver a 750-pound conventional warhead, a 200-kiloton nuclear payload. They designed it to beat our Aegis-class radar defense systems. So not to be outdone, we came out with Raytheon calls it a thing called the C-RAM. That's going to replace the Phalanx, which is a gun. This is actually a modified Sidewinder Stinger combination that flies at Mach 2.1, or Mach 2 or something like that. Yeah, Mach 2. And it only has a range of 11 miles. So the Russians developed a new thing called the Yakant, which has a speed of Mach 2.9 and can fly 180 miles. See, the Iranian, it's a very rugged terrain. And it's just not flat. It's got a lot of mountainous, tough terrain like that. And to give you an idea of what they could face, Iraq had 23 million people and 169,000 square miles. Iran has 66 million people and 636,000 square miles. It's almost four times bigger than Iraq. So if they decide to go after that, boy, you think Iraq's a mess, that would be tough. But the idea that they would do, as far as the future of technology defense against our troops, was just send barrage after barrage. And even though the Raytheon missiles might be able to take out the Exocets, they're clustered in groups of 11, you won't be able to take out the Sunburns or those Yakants because they come in too fast. So, yeah, is it capable? Is the technology in the future capable of seeing American military defeated? Yeah, it's out there. The Russians aren't our friends. You know, this whole thing of the perestroika deception, they're not our friends. And the old bear is rising. So from a technology end, we're looking at some very interesting times. Pray for our troops. They really need them, folks. They desperately need them. All right, and then the future in economics. Now, it's interesting. Right after the election was over, they came out, the CNN did anyways, and no, I don't have cable TV, but you can get it on the news wires and the internet. CNN came out with the concept of peak oil. Now, some of you guys might have heard about that, and they say, well, you know, what's peak oil? And then this is just a little brief review here. Some of you wonder why we're in Iraq. And for some, it's the war on terror. Some think it's an oil grab by a greedy oil man. Some Democrats think it's a madman wanting to destroy the world. Others, it's because Hussein priced his oil in euros and not dollars, and we went in there to take care of him before the rest of the Arabs joined suit, because that would pose a dire threat to our fiat currency. Some of it think it's revenge of Bush because he put a hit out on his dad. And others think it's part of the New World Order moving right along. And I don't know what the motive is, or it's a combination of these two, but maybe President Bush isn't quite the idiot that the Democrats make him out to be. Cheney's no slouch either. These guys are smart men. But if peak oil really is here, and I'll go into that concept, then Bush may be viewed as a genius because he secured the second largest supply of oil in Iraq that there is. You see, back in the 1950s, there was a guy named King Hubbard, and I got to speed things up a little bit. Because he was a geologist that was laughed to scorn because he said in 1970 that the United States oil would plateau, it would crest, and the production would fall off steadily thereafter. And they laughed and said that you're nuts because there's just no limit to this stuff in the ground. Well, 1971, it became true. And since 71, we've become a net increase, and we import more and more oil every year and produce less and less. And you say, well, that's just here. Well, no, supply deterioration of oil fields is commonplace. The Europeans, or specifically the British, and their North Sea oil fields in 2 years will be net importers of oil than rather net exporters and will no longer be energy independent. China, for instance, is up until 2 years ago, was energy independent in regards to oil, and now they're the number two importer of oil behind us. And you say, well, why is our oil so high? What's the reason for that? And part of it's Hurricane Ivan. Now, when Ivan hit, it didn't just a massive amount of damage to our platforms in the Gulf. And not only did that damage to the platforms, but it did damage to the platform pipeline. See, they just don't dump it right into a ship. Those platforms go up into the Gulf in Louisiana. And if you guys look at Lake Michigan, you'll see that the water in Lake Michigan, you know, it goes shallow, deep, and drops off. Well, at the Gulf of the Mississippi, it belches out tons and tons and tons and tons of silt. And what happens to that silt, it accumulates on that ledge and stacks up. And when a hurricane like Ivan comes in on a due north bearing, those waves, if you ever look at a riptide in Lake Michigan, the waves come around. And what they did, they caused an underwater landslide, and it blew half of those a bunch of those pipelines. BP still can't find one of theirs. It moved it a half mile away. There's a couple thousand-foot chunk. They have no clue where that thing's at. So it takes a little time. So our production is down there. That's why our prices went so high. Another reason is that demand is outstripping supply. The fact is that China and India consume more oil every day. In the United States, we use the equivalent of 28 barrels per person. In China, it's 1.7 barrels. And so Asia, with a population of 3.6 billion people, is consuming less oil than our country with 295 million. So the law of supply and demand is going on. You say, well, no, we've got plenty. Just stay with me for a minute here. See, all surplus capacity right now is in Saudi Arabia. And most of that, the Saudi spare capacity, is heavy, what they call heavy sour crude. And rather than the light sweet crude, which our refineries are built to handle. We haven't built any refineries here in 25 years. But that's a problem. A lot of the refineries can't handle that heavy crude. And then another reason is that our currency has depreciated greatly against the euro. And in Nigeria, we get 10% of our oil exports, and then Royal Dutch Petroleum, that's Shell, they control the Nigerian oil fields, and they're in a civil war, and basically they said that if you're working for the oil, you're working for the government, and we'll kill you. So they put out a hit contract on the oilmen that are working the Nigerian fields. So there's a lot of uncertainty in the market. Give you another idea, Mexico. Mexico has the number two field called Cantarell. It's in the Gulf of Mexico, produces 2 million barrels a day. And their reserves, Mexico's reserves in the year 2000 were about 28.4 billion, and then this year they were 12. So the declining reserves, they're reevaluating and looking to see what's out there. And you say, was this voodoo science? No, there's some things you can go on a little bit. But the four big oil fields, what's happened is we found the easy stuff there is to find. Are we running out? No, we're not. But you got the stuff that's easy. The big word that you may hear in the not too distant future is called GAWAR. And GAWAR is, that's the mother load. That is the holy grail of oil fields. And it produces 4.5 million barrels a day. Cantarell, 2 million. A couple other fields produce 1 million. And today we use about 82.5 million barrels of oil per day, and that's what we produce. So demand is barely making supply. So with an increase in population and growth in that, you have some serious problems without bringing a lot of production on. See, GAWAR came on in 1951, and it was producing 5.5 million barrels a day. And today it produces about 4.5 million barrels. And in this oil field alone, there's 3,400 wells tapped into it. Now, the way an oil field works is that it's like a containment vessel if you have a hazardous chemical spill or something like that, where you build a bentonite wall of clay around and you contain the hazardous waste, and then they take care of it. It was super fun. But what you have is you determine the perimeter of your oil field. So if your oil field is shaped like a giant potato like this, what you do is you drill all the oil wells in the potato. And then around the perimeter, you drill perimeter wells, and those become injector wells. And what those do is this well here goes offline and loses pressure. You have to maintain that pressure. If you don't maintain the pressure in a field, your supply drops dramatically. So what they do is turn injector wells, the wells that are the extractor wells and turn them into injector wells. And what happens, your field gradually gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. So what happens then is they take oil out of the ground is you get what's called a water cut. And in GAWAR alone, they're injecting 7 million barrels of water a day. Not gallons, barrels, to take out 4.5 million barrels. When this field came online in 1950, the geologists figured out that it was about 1,300 feet deep. And the current estimates show that it's only about 1,200 feet deep. So what's happening, the world's biggest oil field is beginning to dry up. And what the whole concept of peak oil and what King Hubbard went over was that this oil field goes up like this, and it goes up, up, up gradually, and then without the injection of water in the fields to maintain pressure, it would rapidly go down. So what they have done is it goes up, 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 and then you have all your injectors come online, and they maintain production, and it stays at a fairly flat plateau. But you reach a point where as the oil field shrinks and gets away, then what you have is what is a drop-off and a precipitous plunge to where your production begins to fall 10, 15% a year, and it becomes more expensive to operate the well than you can get the current price of it. And so what's happening with water cut in GAWAR right now, they've got a 30 to 50% water cut. Another big field that they've got, they inject 500,000 barrels of water a day to get out 300,000 barrels of oil. So it's not a cheap process. It's very expensive. And this may be something that you come online and it doesn't bode well, you know, well for the future. And not too many people really know the true state of it because the Saudis are very tight-lipped about this. But back in 1975, Exxon and Mobil and Chevron and Texaco, and this is what these people do. They figured there are about 60 billion barrels in Ghawar, and it's down to about 55 billion have been drawn out. So that's a word that, as you watch, you're going to see this more and more because the press will keep up the attacks on Bush, but this is something that bears watching a little bit. There's nothing you can do about it, but I think that high prices are going to be here to stay. Now that we do have a Republican-controlled Senate and House, it was one vote that stopped them from drilling into the Anwar, the National Wildlife Refuge. If you guys are worried about the environmental catastrophe that'll happen if they drill in there, remember, when they put in the Alaskan pipeline, they said that the spills would destroy the wildlife, that millions of helpless caribou would die, and it would kill and pollute everything. The caribou population is bigger than ever because they breed and they deliver their babies under the pipeline where it's warm, and then there's a lot of lichens and permafrost and food to eat. So lots of this environmental stuff is just environmental stuff. Caribou population's never been stronger. So is the world running out of oil? No, but the policies in the air, they will say that. The environmentalists are going to do that and keep pushing that area. But the $2 gasoline is probably here to stay. Simply laws of supply and demand because it is expensive to find and get this stuff out. Now, there's other technologies. I mean, there's massive deposits of tar sands that are up in Alberta, incredible fields that may be as big as Saudi Arabia. And the way they get this stuff is you have massive underground steam pipes and you kind of cook the oil to free it from the sand. And the biggest investor in the Canadian tar sands is the Chinese. The Chinese have spent billions and billions of dollars acquiring interest in that. There's a reason they're over here grabbing stuff that really is closer to us. They're not our friends. There's oil that's trapped in shale deposits. My brother worked on a dam back in Colorado years ago where they worked, Exxon was building a plant for oil shale. And then the price collapsed when the Arabs dropped the price back in 1982. And that technology and the exploration and extraction of that oil went down. But now at today's price, it's becoming more feasible. But the problem is you take all this oil out of the rock, and what do you do with all that rock? There's a lot of it because it's kind of a hazardous thing to deal with. But cheap oil, and it's easily extracted, is probably going to be near its end, and you'll hear about that. And, Marty's a farmer, and then, like, the ethanol plants, they're coming online. So before you go, the sky is falling or anything like that, I'm not trying to say that, but just the state of the nation, the state of the future is an interesting thing. There's other alternatives, even looking at biodiesel and things like that as things come on board. But the future's interesting. It's got a lot of stuff in holds. And we can look at the past and we can learn from the other mistakes. Don't be a fool and try to predict the end time and the exact date of the rapture. You'll wind up like that chicken lady did. And we can laugh at the foolish things of today. It's stupid to build a city in a desert. It's stupid to build a city like San Francisco on fill and material soils that liquefy when you hit it with an earthquake. That's a dumb thing to do, folks. And, God will have, don't worry, it's coming. And we can laugh at those things of today, but we can look forward to the future, and we can look forward to it with hope and not fear. So many people in the whole, much of this country looks forward to it with a tremendous pessimism. And the campaign was just incredible how pessimistic and, doom and gloom it was. And, it was just a very nasty, bitter fight. And Graham did say one thing. He said, "I don't know what the future holds, but I do know hope holds the future." And we can take, the news, good and bad, and we can sit there and put our heads in the sand and cry and whine or moan or worry about the New World Order and worry about all of these conspiracy theories and Masonic this and get so involved in that it'll steal your joy for Jesus Christ. It'll steal your purpose in life. It'll steal your purpose to witness. I have a friend that know well. He is convinced by all kinds of numerology extractions in Sanskrit that the Antichrist is Elvis Presley and his brother is his evil twin brother is going to be a false prophet. You say, no. Guy was in a conservative, Bible-believing church. But you know what? You mess with this book, God will mess with your mind. It's real simple. Don't think you can do it. See, 2 Timothy 2:1-7 says, "God hath not given us a spirit of fear, but of power, love, and a sound mind." And our focus is to stay on Jesus Christ. That's what we're to do. So when you hear all these wars and rumors of wars and things that are coming up, just remember, we're to look forward for his appearing and not for all this gloomy end time stuff. And with that, I think we're about out of time. It's 10:47, so let's get started.